Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by eatdrinkindy.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink Indy. Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD to the Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we have got an eclectic show for you, full of interviews that focus on all sorts of aspects of our local food scene, from using a local ingredient to launching a new business to reopening a local restaurant. First, we'll head to the North End Barbecue and Moonshine, where we'll talk pawpaws with bar manager Jason Faust and chef Mitch McDaniel. Then we'll have a cup of coffee with Andy and Sarah Hessler of Blue Mine Roasting and hear about how they got into the coffee roasting business. Then we'll go to Griner's Sub Shop, a longtime neighborhood restaurant at Raymond and Shelby Streets, and hear from owner Lisa Moreno Moyer. She tells us how her business has reopened after it was destroyed and an employee gravely injured in a crash last February. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Pawpaws. Now, that's an Indiana ingredient you don't hear much about. Unless, like me, you hear the neighborhood ice cream truck playing way down yonder in the pawpaw patch over and over and over. But just what is a pawpaw, and why is that tune a common folk song all across the Midwest and into the South? As it turns out, the pawpaw tree is found from New York to Nebraska and from northern Florida all the way to Canada. And those trees do indeed grow in patches, or groves, beneath other trees, and they yield the largest edible fruits native to North America. They look a bit like a pear, taste a bit like a banana, and they have the slippery feel of a mango when you peel it. They're not the easiest fruits to deal with. There are big seeds inside, and unless you get a really large pawpaw, there's really not a lot of fruit to work with. They haven't been commercially cultivated until recently, which means that if you do have pawpaws, you probably really have been to the pawpaw patch. Or, like Jason Faust and Mitch McDaniel of the North End Barbecue and Moonshine, you have a forager who has. I stopped by the North End the other day, and bar manager Jason Faust and chef Mitch McDaniel told me what they're doing with these old-fashioned Indiana fruits.
They're local, I've known about them, but I haven't really experienced or done much with it, especially with cocktails. It's a flavor I've heard about, you know, whether it's mango or pear or apple or banana. So curious, and you know, Meredith, our sous chef Le Harvest, they work with the local forager that I got a hold of a bunch, and she sent something over here to Mitch and I, and like, well, let's dive into this and come to find out they're labor intensive. You know, you got to peel off the skin. They've got these giant dense seeds you've got to get out, and they've got this layer, this kind of sack around them that you got to peel off, and they don't yield a lot. And the flavor itself, just eating it, isn't real prominent of any flavor notes. So
maybe this is why we don't know much about pawpaws.
Yeah, true. So I just kind of dove into some, kind of picked out the ones that were pretty ripe, pretty soft. Peeled off the skin, got the seeds out, and I figured it was pretty mushy. It's kind of, that's more banana texture, like overripe banana, maybe mango. So I pureed it with a little bit of simple syrup, some sugar and water, and let it sit. And overnight, it kind of developed more of of apple and maybe a little bit of tropical fruit flavors. And then I started experimenting with the drink, and I thought, well, in the past, I've done some tropical flavors with scotch. It's a whiskey bar. We've been working on some scotch cocktails. So I used Monkey Shoulder Scotch, which is nice, versatile, balanced scotch. Doesn't lean too far one way or the other. I used some of that pureed pawpaw, sweetened a bit, some fresh lemon. We have a chamomile tea syrup that we made fresh with some bold Hubbard and Craven's chamomile tea, and then just a little bit of peach bitters. And I think all the elements work. You know, you can tell it's a little viscous, it's a little thick, so I think it's you got to get it balanced properly so it's not thick on the mouth, the viscosity. But
it's a great cocktail, oddly tropical, yeah. Appealing and pretty. You know, and so I think that maybe this is a great thing to do with pawpaws, yeah. is to puree them and make a cocktail. But Mitch, tell me about them from a chef perspective, you know, and any potential you see in pawpaws?
Yeah, absolutely. Like we say, it's more indicative of a tropical fruit. I wouldn't see why you couldn't make a nice cobbler or a dessert out of them. We were talking about perhaps roasting them in the skin and maybe concentrating some of that flavor. Like we said, it's pretty blank slate, so it would need a lot of help as far as some sugar and maybe a little bit of ginger or something like that. But as far as like an early fall dessert, yeah, doing a nice crisp topping or something like that, I think would be a beautiful dessert.
Yeah. Now, as we've talked about, there's probably a reason why we don't see more of pawpaws. Is it anything that you run across very often?
This is honestly maybe the second time I've even seen pawpaws available, and definitely the first time that I've been able to get a hold of them locally. So we're pretty excited to have them here, and it's a nice touch as far as something weird, something different, but then altogether local as well. So yeah, we were really excited when we got the call, like, hey, we got some pawpaws. Cool, where'd you get them? And the guy's like, the woods. So
because it is an indigenous tree, you know, they're a native Indiana tree, so it's a fruit that theoretically you could just find out in the woods, but as we've seen, not something that looks to be particularly commercially viable,
right.
So like you said, lots of seeds. I don't know what else you would do with them, you know.
Yeah, it's hard telling. Make a nice pawpaw applesauce or something. I don't know. but yeah, I think, why couldn't you do pawpaw pie or anything? I think anything that you can maybe do with a mango or maybe do with, if you catch them right at the right ripeness, maybe do with a pear or something like that. I think you could maybe switch out for pawpaw and have this nice local forage spin on an old dessert that, you know, you've normally been using something more standby-ish.
Well, I can see how they could substitute for pear, because, you know, if you imagine an underripe pear that might not have a whole lot of intrinsic flavor, so this I could see some similarities there.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, like we said, a little overripe banana if you catch them at the wrong time, and underripe pear if you catch them at the right time. So, yeah.
So, but clearly the cocktail is a winner, you know, and that's something that I think that people would enjoy. Could they actually get a pawpaw cocktail?
Yeah. Yep. Like I said, because out of the I think 2.5 pounds we got, the nice thing is you don't need a lot, because the flavor doesn't serve as much purpose as maybe some other purees. So it's more of a base and something to work off of. So I think it could go longer. So the yield might be better in that manner. So yeah, I mean, we'll have it and we'll continue to experiment. But I think I've got a good start here. So this one definitely, I think, anyone could drink, so you know, until supplies last, I guess, you know. And again, like you said, I don't know seasonality. It's something that's really made me dive into, you know, the interwebs to see what you know, what else I could find out about the pawpaw, and you know, obviously how far it's reached, the seasonality, and those kind of things. Because this is the fun part about bartending, where it's come, is these weird ingredients and fruits I've never used before, so I'm gonna figure it out.
We've been talking with Jason Faust and Mitch McDaniel of the North End Barbecue Moonshine about pawpaws. For a limited time, you can try the pawpaw cocktail at the North End. For information on the restaurant, go to thenorthendbbq.com. We are back here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, where we often talk with local food artisans and entrepreneurs, folks who've taken a hobby or specialty and turned it into a business. Today we're talking coffee with an Indianapolis couple who have launched Blue Mind Roasting. Andy and Sarah Hessler weren't entrepreneurs and didn't have a food biz background when they started getting into coffee. But that didn't stop them from growing Andy's coffee roasting hobby into a business. Blue Mind Coffee, roasted in their backyard roastery, is now available in a handful of local stores. Andy tells us how it all started, and yes, there was a popcorn popper involved.
For us, it started with the popcorn popper, as it sometimes does. But first, I just wanted to, we had been in Louisville and really liked the coffee scene there and really knew a lot of people connected to it. And just kind of getting into that third wave coffee movement, somewhere there's a tendency to roast a little bit lighter, to pay more attention to origins, to flavors, just having more care with the roasting, and really enjoyed that. So when we moved here, not that there weren't some good coffee shops and things going on in Indy, but where we were just wasn't quite as accessible as it was. And so bought this popcorn popper and started. There's a place called Sweet Maria's that sells a lot of, to a lot of home roasters, green coffee, and you can learn a lot about coffee roasting there. And so just started buying green coffee and just roasting for fun with the popcorn popper.
Now, so a popcorn popper, I mean, this is just like a real hot air popcorn popper, right?
Well, it was an air popper. I think it was Poppery 2. I bought it off of eBay. I think it's like manufactured in 1980-something. But
so they're old-school popcorn poppers.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The one I had was, and those tend to be popular. Yeah, and it was old-school, and there wasn't a lot of thought for me. I just put it in. There's not a lot of heat control. You just put it in and turn it on, and it goes. I had it in a box, kind of trying to control the air or the temperature with whether the box was open, but yeah.
So you just put it in there and turn it on?
And it took, I don't know, maybe 3 to 5 minutes. It would start to turn yellow and turn brown, and then coffee starts to crack. And when it's getting close to being done, there's a first crack and a second crack, and different people, depending on how you roast, stop it at different times. So it went through that whole cycle, and yeah.
So how were those first coffee beans roasted? How did it come out early on?
It was okay. it wasn't like what I was getting in Louisville at places like Sonnergass Coffee or Quill's there. But it was a little bit lighter how I was wanting it. So I was getting a little more of the fruit notes that I was kind of hoping for. But it wasn't great by any means, and I've learned a lot about roasting since then that's helped bring out more of the flavors. So
how long did you do that? How long was it, you know, a hobby that you were, you know, fooling with a popcorn popper?
Probably 6 or 9 months, and then decided to buy a home roaster to kind of take it to the next level, and with the thought that maybe we would go into business at some point, but at the time not really sure, and just kind of wanting to roast better coffee than the popcorn popper.
Now, Sarah, what did you think about this? Were you into the coffee too? Were you roasting and kind of getting into this as it first started out as a hobby?
The funny thing is I did not like coffee at all. Actually, probably the first coffee I ever drank and liked was coffee that Andy had roasted on, I don't know if I drank it from the popcorn popper, that coffee. Probably not. It was maybe more when he started home roasting on the hot top is when I would start drinking it. And he would get an Ethiopia Natural, which is a really flavorful coffee, blueberry notes. Really fell in love with it. That was kind of the first time that I really started drinking coffee, which is kind of funny.
So how did it grow from there, from getting some coffee that people were starting to like? And then is that when you started thinking, well, you know, maybe this could be something?
Yeah, when I was roasting on the hot top, that home roaster, we started giving samples to people and getting good feedback. And I learned a lot about the roasting process and was feeling a little more confident about it. And when people were saying, I liked it, but when other people were saying they liked it too, that's kind of when we were thinking more seriously about doing something with it.
Because we're sitting right now in a coffee roastery, you know, that you have built, you know, behind your home. So did you envision this early on?
I don't think we envisioned the roastery per se, because we didn't know what we were getting into. At first we thought maybe we could just do this in our basement in our house, which is when we realized that coffee's treated like any other food product, we realized that wasn't going to work. So we did know that it was we were gonna have to take things up a notch, but the extent we have, I don't think at the very beginning we were quite sure of. But
when did you know that? When did you decide that this is what you're gonna do?
Right. Well, it's when people started liking it, we knew we wanted to, we had kind of decided some other work I had been doing kind of dried up, and it was like kind of the perfect time to try something different. And so we knew we wanted to sell it on some level. So we were confident of that. But the more we pried into it, we realized this was going to be a little more complicated, and we were going to need things like water, sinks, toilets, signs that say employees must wash hands, and all these things. So it just was kind of a slow realization. And then we made the decision to build this space.
Now, when was that? Like what year? How long have you been roasting in here?
The building finished up in December of 2015. So we've only been in here for about 9-10 months.
2016 was the year then that this became a real coffee roastery.
That's right. Yeah. So the beginning of the year was when it really all started.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have seen it in various stores around Indianapolis, Blue Mind Coffee. So tell me about how the name came about and then how you started getting your coffee out there.
Right. The name comes from a song by a singer-songwriter named Alexi Murdoch, off an album that was, I think, 2007 or 8. And the song's called Blue Mind. And my take on the song is it's just about losing yourself kind of in your thoughts, slowing down, just kind of pulling back a little bit from the fast pace of the modern world to just reflect. And that was always kind of my experience of really good coffee, was slowing down. You know, it takes some time to grind. If you're going to do a pour over, you really notice things that you don't normally notice if you just go to the local Starbucks, or if you're running it through a automatic drip or whatever. And so and then just taking some time to slow down and drink a nice cup of coffee, notice the flavors, and just kind of get lost in your thoughts. And it's something that it just kind of, the song just kind of went together with my experience of coffee, very much taking some time in the morning to reflect and slow down. And so that's where the name came from, and it kind of speaks to this larger vision we have of that idea of slowing down and kind of taking a step back from the fast-paced world to focus on the things that matter a little bit more.
So how do you go from, having a name to getting it into the stores?
We had a friendship with the folks at Agrarian, because we have backyard chickens, and Sarah especially spent a lot of time in there learning about chickens and buying feed. And so they were the first ones to start carrying it. And then Sarah does a lot of the kind of the business side of things and reaching out to people. We both do, but she does it more, and that's kind of partly her side of things.
Where did you see it going?
We really wanted it to be at places that Indy considered like their local go-to grocery place, that other local goods were sold there as well. So we have it at Wildwood down in Fountain Square and Goose the Market and Pogue's Run and Homespun on Mass Ave. So just different little parts of Indy that are known for having good local goods. So,
and at the Safeway at 56th and Illinois, which is where people pop in for a gallon of milk and coffee, I would imagine.
Definitely, yes. Safeway, it's kind of funny. Not everybody would think that we would have our coffee at Safeway, but it's been great. I love the manager, Jeff. He has been awesome having our coffee there on the shelves, and it sells really well there. And so it's our neighborhood where we live, and so it works out really perfect.
We've been talking with Andy and Sarah Hessler of Blue Mind Roasting. Stay with us for more about Blue Mind here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Jolene Ketzenberger, and we are talking coffee today here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio with an Indianapolis couple who have launched a coffee business from their backyard roastery. Andy and Sarah Hessler of Blue Mind Roasting started by roasting coffee for themselves, then for friends, and it just grew from there. But as Andy points out, there was no business background or food experience leading up to this at all.
No. That's a resounding no. We did not. And actually, for us to start a business is one of the probably last things we thought we would be doing in our life. We are not, like, by nature. Sarah's actually probably more entrepreneurial than I am by nature. So our love for coffee is really what's driven it, although we have had to learn and are still learning a lot about what that means, and we still feel like we have a lot to learn. So, you know, we have family and friends who have started businesses and done well, and they were always inspiring to us. And so we were smart enough to where we could figure enough out to do what we needed to do, as long as, you know, the passion was there and the vision was there for what we wanted to do. And so, it takes some faith and it takes some courage, and we're still, you know, having to do that as we push into it and hoping that it work. You know, you continue to hope that things continue to work. And so, and we're kind of learning a lot as we go.
So when did you start thinking of yourselves as coffee roasters?
It did kind of change. We were kind of just more like, we do stuff at home, we're homebrewer, you know, we brew our barista or whatever at home. And but then when Andy decided that he was going to, because really he's the backbone of Blue Mind, I would say, since he's the roaster. But when he decided that, yeah, we're going to take a stab at this, it was kind of like, oh, you are a coffee roaster, and like, you are definitely kind of, that was never a label he had before, you know, like he had done other jobs. And so it's kind of like now he's the coffee guy, you know, in our circles. So it's kind of fun to like have something you're really passionate about and to be able to educate people and to share that passion with others. And it's funny how people just kind of come along and, you know, they're buying, you know, different apparatuses to brew coffee now, and they have scales and, you know, all different kinds of things to be able to brew coffee at home a lot better.
So how does that feel to now be the coffee guy?
Yeah, it is different. I really like it. It's fun to me. And because I love coffee, and I know people love coffee, and really, I mean, we say this sometimes, that the coffee really doesn't need us. It can sell itself, because, I mean, it's just an amazing it's an amazing thing, going from this green dried up thing to this aromatic with all this flavor. And then there's all these ways you can brew it and grind it, and just how minute changes in roasting or brewing can bring out different flavors. It's just a fascinating thing. And so it's fun to me to have some knowledge that not everybody has, but to kind of help them and to watch them kind of explore it themselves and drink coffee that tastes better and to taste all these flavors. And coffee also has an element that it brings people together, and there's a community aspect to it, I think. So that's been really fun to me to be a part of that.
What were some of the challenges in launching your own sort of culinary-related business? I know a lot of people kind of have that dream of being an entrepreneur and launching a business. Were there anything that was, you know, especially difficult?
Yeah, there were a lot of things, I think, that were difficult. Just the fear of the unknown is the biggest thing. And not having a culinary background, not having a business background. So just that fear. And then when we were trying to build this space, things kept going wrong, and which I'm sure is the case with a lot of people that are constructing new things. So you're always afraid that something's not going to work out. But I think for us, having a passion first, rather than just, I'm going to go start a business just to start a business, I think the passion for the coffee, and then just the larger vision behind what we feel like we're doing, has been the thing that's kept us going.
So this is ramping up, it looks like. How did that go?
It's just been a kind of a slower step-by-step process for us. We both have other part-time jobs. We have three kids. So we're not all in all the way. And so it's been a little slower, but we were just trying to take it one step at a time.
You know, does the delivery driver come up, pull up to your house with a big bag of coffee beans? You know, how does that happen, and how does that get to what's in my cup of coffee here?
Right. So we buy from, there's a couple of different green coffee importers that we buy from that are pretty well, the ones we use are pretty well known in the specialty coffee world as being good, solid places that find good, good green coffee and pay a good, fair price for it. And, recently we've been buying these larger orders, which have to be shipped freight, and we had to figure out how to make it work, because a semi has to pull up and it comes on a pallet.
Oh my goodness. Mm-hmm.
So that was a little trickier, and we had to figure some things out. But again, it's like one of those things where all right, how do we do this now and make it work with this kind of life that we're doing it with? We don't have a storefront with like an easy, like a back door that's easy to get it into. So
right there, there's not the loading dock and the shipping entrance and that sort of
right,
thing.
Right, exactly. So it's just taken some creativity to figure it out.
Mm-hmm. So when the coffee arrives, you have several bags here that are right behind us. Then what happens next? You know, how long does it take? You know, and you know, are you, you know, filling orders now? Are you roasting, you know, different styles of coffee? What are you doing now?
Mm-hmm. So we typically have three different origins or different kinds of coffee. We do single origins. So we have from one country. So we have a Burundi, a Guatemala. Although we did start one called Midtown Roast, which is the origin may change, but the characteristics we try to keep the same. But it's still going to be a single origin. So right now it's from Colombia. So I'm putting in there about 4.5 pounds at a time. So it's a smaller roaster, which is kind of the way we've done things. It's just kind of smaller and slower at first. So yeah.
How do you see the company growing? Do you want it to grow? I mean, is this, what's the vision?
We definitely would love to see it grow. We don't plan to be huge. It just wouldn't work with our life. But the idea of having it here locally in Indianapolis is really where we want it. And having it brewed in places would be optimal. We would love to have a few places that would serve it so people could, since we don't have a storefront, it would be great for people to have a place to go try it. And then we love having it at the local shops, groceries, for people to be able to experience really great coffee at home.
We've been talking coffee and business with Andy and Sarah Hessler of Blue Mind Roasting. For more information and to find their coffee, go to bluemindroasting.com. Well, this past week was a big one for local sub shop and food truck owner Lisa Moreno Moyer. This past Wednesday, Lisa reopened Griner's Sub Shop, a longtime local business that was destroyed 7 months ago when an SUV crashed into it. Griner's employee Tina Scruggs was gravely injured in the crash, and after 21 surgeries and $2 million in medical bills, she too is back on her feet, though still with considerable health challenges. I stopped by Griner's the day before the grand reopening to talk with Lisa about the crash last February and what it's been like putting Griner's back together.
So this is, you know, been 7+ months in the making, but we have, this has been, I call it a labor of love. We have walked alongside an employee over these many months, and at the same time, while she's trying to rebuild her life, we're trying to rebuild a shop. And it's something that you never expect that you're going to need to balance. But the fact is that those are the cards that I was dealt with, and those are the cards that she was dealt with. And now, you know, we move forward. So I think that, you know, the reopening of Griner's is it's been a long journey for a lot of people, and you never really realize how many lives how many people are touched in good and bad ways by situations like this that we went through. And, you know, you wish that you'd never go through it, but I think it would be fair to say that we've all grown through it, through this experience as well.
So kind of catch us up and kind of go through what happened, you know, back 7 months ago.
Certainly. At 5:30 in the morning, a woman that was on meth, and I understand she'd been up all night too, she believed there were people in our sub shop that were going to hurt someone, and she felt it was her job to go in and, from what I've understood and been told, that she was going to go in and help. And she just drove through in her SUV, drove through the front of our sub shop, and ran over our 31-year employee. She had been with Grinders at 31 years at that point. Ran her over tragically, and
pretty much destroyed the building.
Completely destroyed the building. You know, people always say, "Oh yeah, we're down to the studs." Even those got replaced. So yeah, the walls on the outside standing. Some of those were saved, but all of the ones in the front, that those weren't even saved. So yeah, it was completely gutted.
So explain a little bit about what you thought when you first heard that had happened early that morning.
Well, you know, I've recalled that when you see a 327 number show up on your phone, and I'd heard that there was an accident on the south part of downtown, but when you see the 327 number, I knew immediately it was the city of Indianapolis, and I knew it would end up being the police. So your first thought is I was stunned. I'll be honest. I was a little stunned, but I couldn't necessarily envision in my mind, you know, what I was going to come into. And until you stand in front of it, you know, you don't really realize that every single thing that you ever put time into buying, like equipment, refrigerators, artwork, everything, it's gone. It's all gone. But also, I think when you're put into a situation like this, that's when people always say, you know, those things aren't going to last forever. That's when it's put in front of you, because at that point in time, it was so less about the structure at that time. That all came much later, but it was about our employee.
Tell me about your employee and what her injuries were.
Well, Tina, like I said, she has been here for 31 years. She has had around 20 surgeries. Her medical bills probably at this point have exceeded $2 million. And she has been as strong in this recovery as I knew her before. She's a very resilient person, and she does an unimaginable number of hours of therapy. It's unimaginable, the number of hours that she does. And but it's brought her to this place where she is able to walk with the aid of a cane, or a walker, rather. And she has... is still very much engaged in physical therapy. She does not have the use of her right arm. One of her legs, her left leg, ended up being badly disfigured. But if I were to recount the types of surgeries and the numbers, some people might not believe me, but yeah.
So this was a massive thing that happened to your work family here at Grinders. How did you start to rebuild? Because at this point, you've reopened.
Right. Well, I mean, when people say one day at a time, I mean, that's really literally. And in the beginning, it's all a waiting game with surgeries and finding out what the family needs. The community was absolutely terrific in coming together with a GoFundMe. And the GoFundMe was very intentional. You know, you have to be careful with GoFundMes, I think, in this day and age, in that you want to be very intentional and careful with the money that people give. But it was going to be very clear, even with insurance covering her medical, it was going to be very clear that they would have some other incidental needs. And so that was, I think that really I saw that as being my first project, because initially I did not want to do any interviews with television stations, any of the stations, until I made a decision that I wanted to do a GoFundMe. And then I had said no to all of them, and then within, I think it was a half hour, I invited all of them back. I called them. I said, hey, okay, I'll talk to you.
Well, I'm sure it was very difficult to sort of wrap your head around the situation and what needed to be done and how and when.
Well, it is, because, you know, it's nobody gets training on how to deal with an emergency situation like this. You just, you walk down new roads and you learn as you go, you know. And that's where your basic life skills of asking a lot of questions and just making the best decisions that you can, you just use those basic skills to rebuild a business, stand by an employee, and you know, take a wide scope view. I mean, you've got your strategical plan that you have to have to rebuild, and then you have the tactical, where you just have to roll up your sleeves and do things. But then you have to think big picture and take care of not just one employee, but the other employees, and what does this mean, and you know, and how can we help you find new work, and you know, so it's there are a lot of people involved, and that takes time. So the scope and the type of work that I did changed from what I was doing every day to that.
So you have spent the last 7 months getting everything in shape to reopen.
Exactly. And I would say many of those months were 7 days a week, too. So, but you know, I live with this, and I say this, and I'll say it till my Costco casket, and that is that there's always somebody that's worse off than you. There's always somebody worse off than me. Now, there's always somebody that's better off than me, too, but I don't worry about that because, you know, I'm pretty happy with, regardless of the circumstances, you know, every day is a good day.
We've been talking with Lisa Moreno-Moyer of Griner's Sub Shop about the crash last February that destroyed her business and severely injured an employee. We'll be back with more from Lisa about Griner's here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, on WFYI and WFYI.org. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and we are back here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio talking about the reopening of Griner's Sub Shop. That shop has been located near the intersection of Raymond and Shelby Streets in Indianapolis since 1969, although at one time there were several Griner's around the city. But this was the last one, and unfortunately a crash last February destroyed the building and terribly injured an employee. But happily, the shop has been rebuilt, the grand reopening has been held, and now owner Lisa Moreno-Moyer tells us what makes Griner's special, what it means to the neighborhood, and how she knew she had to be a part of it.
You know, it's been very intentional for me to try and not change just the face and the spirit of Griner's. And, you know, we're not very fancy. And so I really wanted to make sure in the actual rebuild itself to just let the original spirit of Griner's come through. But there's only so much of the original spirit at a certain point you can keep. But the new Griner's will be clearly what Griner's since 1969 was born and bred from, which is our sub sandwiches. And I will hold these sub sandwiches up to any sub here in Indianapolis, in the Midwest, and even on the East Coast. And it's our bread. We have this bread from scratch that we make that's just fabulosity. So we will do that. And the neat thing is we will be able to combine the Mac Genie mac and cheese. We bought the rights to that now a little over a year ago. And we're excited that we will have a better facility and equipment to be able to feed the masses with the Mac Genie mac and cheese, which is really, it's quite something. And it had a small cult following when we bought it. And so we want to expand with that. And, you know, we're going to put a new emphasis on our salads, too. We are very cognizant of gluten-free. I now have a daughter two really, that are mostly gluten-free. And you can get any sub sandwich. As much as I love our bread, you can make a saladwich, which is your sandwich on a bed of lettuce. And so, our goal is to be able to serve vegetarians, those that are gluten-free, and those that just want a party.
So when people pull up to the Griners, what are they going to see? What does it look like now, and how is it different? So maybe tell me a little bit about what it was like since the 60s, because it has been here that whole time, right?
Right, really, it has been. So you will see we made the ugly building a little prettier. I think it looks a lot better. We have the fun garage door that with, limited times during the year, but we'll still have opportunities to be able to open that. We really want to continue to be that sense of community for our regular customers these people are faithful.
You have devoted customers, right? Who've been coming for years and years.
Oh yeah. I mean, these people over the last few months, they call me at 11:30 at night, and they're caring, they're loving people, but they're aggressive.
And they want their sandwiches back, right?
They want their sandwiches back. They're pretty aggressive, though. We hope that with our indoor and outdoor seating and just the facelift of Griners, that it will not only be the home again for our past faithful customers, but some new ones as well. And I think the unfortunate exposure that you get in a circumstance like this prove to be an interesting form of marketing, if you will. And it has been some of the greatest marketing representatives of Griners have been past customers telling new people that when it opens, you need to get your keys and get in your car and go, because it's a sandwich, but it's more than just a sandwich. It's a sub just is one that you can't get. And I'm not anti any other sub shop. I really don't consider like the Subways a competitor. We just do something so different. It's so different. We are local, and of course. There is a growing population, as you know. I read even recently, it might have been in IBJ, that how some of the chain restaurants, their numbers are getting hit, and they're being impacted greater than ever now by the local eateries. And I say yay to the local eateries.
Well, tell me a little bit about the history of Griners and how you kind of came into that.
Oh, wow. Sure, Jolene, you can ask me that. Well, I mean, the seed history is Ray Griner in 1969 started this this great sub shop. And my fairy tale says that once upon a time, Ray Griner had a dream to have the best sub shop and the best food in the whole wide world. That's the fairy tale. But the truth is that I opened up probably the fifth food truck maybe in Indianapolis. It was a sweet truck. And that kind of got me in I left the business world and came into this culinary world in some form or another. And I ended up stumbling upon, shall we say, Griners, and heard about it. And when I first walked in, I had never been into grinders. I had never heard of grinders before, but I knew that I was supposed to buy it. I knew.
Now, how many grinders were there at the time, and how many had there been?
Okay, great question. Great question. This was the last grinders, and it has been verified with me that there were some other locally owned grinders, and then there were franchises. And I always say this about a franchise. If you don't know how to franchise, don't franchise. And I place no judgment on the family that of grinders that franchise. But I think that they, well, clearly it didn't work. So
this was the very last one.
Yes, but I also heard there was one in Japan. Serious, not kidding. Yeah, so we're international. So this was the last one, yeah. And the plan was I was going to partner with the guy that owned it. And at the 11th hour, he had decided he didn't want a partner. So I needed to figure out in 24 hours how to buy it. And even at that point, he didn't want to sell. And it was a fight at a table in the center of the dining room. A friendly fight, but a firm one at that.
Now, why did you want it so much? And how did you know when you walked in, like you said, that this was the place that you wanted to have?
Well, at that point, I'd already been based out of here and started working and with the intent that we were going to partner together. So I'll never fully be able to explain to you how I knew I was supposed to buy it. I just, you know, I did, and I dared to dream, and I don't usually sit on my dreams that long. I, like, get up and figure, okay, what's the first thing I can do, even if it's a small step? And I think that's what I did. And then once you get going, it's like a snowball, and then it gets a little bit bigger going down the hill, and it also goes a little bit faster. So I guess I'm a snowball.
So it started going fast. So tell me when you became a part of it and how long you've been here.
So it's now been 2 years. I've been around for 2.5 years with Grinders, but I bought it 2 years ago on October 8th. And we bought it and I think reopened it 48 hours later because I bought it with the food in the walk-in. I said, I want the food in the walk-in too. And because, you know, anyone in the restaurant business knows that one shopping trip can set you back the price of a car. And so I negotiated that in. And, of course, food's got to get used up pretty quick. So that's how we started. And, of course, we already knew how to run it. And but the fun part was ahead of us. We knew that now we could run it any way we wanted to. And, you know, when a customer comes to our line now, the very first thing is, hi, what's your name? Because we're serving somebody that has a name. Somebody took time to give that person a name when they were a baby. And I believe we need to use it. So they come in, and we like to know who's on the other side of the glass. And it's just it might be a 3-minute relationship with them at that point in time from the time they order the sandwich till the time they pay. But it's going to be a good 3-minute relationship.
So you've really embraced and been embraced by the neighborhood.
Yes, we've been very embraced. You know what? We kind of have a couple neighborhoods. So I think and what I mean by that is Garfield Park and Fountain Square people are terrific. We do get a lot of downtown people. But we have a cult following from people from the east side that used to go to the Grinders on Shadeland. It's really fabulous because I could have paid this building off. I had a dollar for every time a person came in and informed me that there used to be a Grinders on Shadeland. I said, stop it. Get out of here.
Really?
So yeah. Hey, did you know there was a Grinder? I did. I knew it. And I'll tell you what, if the building from that old Grinders, it's a pizza place now, if it ever goes up for sale, I will be at that bidding auction for that. Trust me. You know, and at a certain point in time, I can see another Grinders on the east side. But those are our people. Our people come from the east side, and they're and of course, I mean, I have one guy that comes in from North Dakota. I don't know how many times a year, and he'll be here. Grand opening. Oh, no. He's already made it clear. And when he flies into town, he does not go to his family's house until he stops at Grinders first. He always stops at Grinders first and then goes to see the family. And then on his way out of town, he stops here before he goes to the airport. And there's a lot of him. They're out there, people that come from New Palestine, people that drive from Columbus.
And now, why is that? What is it about Griners that, has made that connection over the years?
I think it's a combination. I always have the simple philosophy, and I think it's great food. And subs can be great food. I mean, you know, there's lots of great, fabulous food out there, and we're in our own category. It's called sub sandwich, and it's really great. I mean, when you start from house-made bread that's made at, you know, 5 in the morning, it makes a difference. It does. And I think that coupled with that every single customer of ours that comes in here, we love you. We might not like you on some days, but we really love you. We do. We love all of our customers. They're just awesome. And I'll tell you what, you'll get somebody that might come in here wearing a $3,000 suit, and right behind them will be somebody that comes in and maybe they make $3,000 a year. And they're going to get the exact same sandwich with the exact same service. And they're just all good people to us.
We've been talking with Lisa Moreno-Moyer about the reopening of the Classic Griners Sub Shop in Indianapolis. For more information, look for Griners Sub Shop on Facebook. I'm Jolene Katzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thanks so much for tuning in to this week's show, and thanks also to our guests, Jason Faust and Mitch McDaniel of the North End Barbecue and Moonshine, Andy and Sarah Hessler of Blue Mine Roasting, and Lisa Moreno-Moyer of Griner's Sub Shop, Scout's Treats, Mac Genie, and The Bark Truck. And thanks also to producer John Katzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio.